Greetings and welcome back to another in our ongoing series of lectures on the Book of Esther. My name is Yitzhak Etshalom, and we are now about to begin the fifth chapter of the Book of Esther, Esther Perakei. Just to remind you from the previous podcast, Mordechai has come to Esther presenting her evidence of Haman's treachery and heinous conspiracy against the Jewish people. And Esther has responded that she can't go to the king. Mordechai had his three arguments as to why she should indeed go to the king. And then Esther commanded Mordechai in a very significant turnaround in their relationship to have all of the Jews in Shushan fast for 3 days, and then she would go into the king. Vayhi bayom hashlishi. It was on the third day. This is the third day of fasting, which tells you that it was not really 3 full days of fasting, because evidently she began fasting on the day that she commanded, which is in the middle of the day, then the next day, and now it's the third day. So perhaps it was a day and a half, to all told, or 2 days. Nonetheless, it's still quite a bit. Esther put on her royal finery, the famous Midrash Chazal, Vatubash Esther Malchut, that she put on Ruach HaKodesh and was clothed in the Holy Spirit, Divine Spirit. Nonetheless, the simple pshat is Vatubash Esther Malchut, she put on her royal garments, Vata'amod B'chatzar Beit HaMelech HaPanimit, she went into the inner courtyard of the king. So imagine the structure being as follows, that the king's throne room is in the center, and around it or outside of it there is an inner courtyard, and outside of it there's an outer courtyard. Terms, as I mentioned in the last podcast, which are also used in the Book of Yechezkel to describe various precincts of the Beit HaMikdash. The parallels are deliberate, as we spoke about at the very beginning of the series. And she came into the inner courtyard, Nochach Beit HaMelech, facing the room of the king, the throne room. V'hamelech yoshev al kisei malchuto, the king was sitting on his throne, beveit hamalchut, in beit hamalchut, or beit hamelech, nochach petach habayit, facing the door. So he is facing, as she comes, he sees her, he is inside, she is outside, and we are getting a scene very reminiscent of, in rabbinic literature, of a description of the Kohen Gadol going into the Kodesh Kodoshim on Yom HaKippurim, thus strengthening all of the beautiful parallels, Yom Kippurim, and the association of the Goral and the lottery. Much of that is built around this image here. One of my students pointed out recently that the word Melech appears quite a bit in this and the next Pasuk, and noted that the reason for that was that the entire scene here is one of a climactic meeting. After all that's gone on, Esther has not been to the king's, have been not summoned to the king for 30 days. Esther has undergone a very deliberate and very telling transformation internally, as we've spoken about. And now at this very powerful moment, she, the queen, comes in to see the king in the house of royalty, etc. And what happens? Vahi, and now everything hangs in the balance. Remember, if the king does not recognize her, she's dead. Vahi chirot ha-melech et Esther ha-malka omedet b'chatzer, nasachen b'inav. The king saw Esther, and she found favor in his eyes, which is quite a feat for somebody who's been fasting for a few days. So he raised the scepter, and we all let out a collective sigh. Vatikrav Esther, and Esther came close. Vatiga berosh hasharvit. She touched the tip of the scepter, which is a sign of acceptance and subservience, akin to kissing the ring, things of that sort. So Esther has now successfully passed the first hurdle. She's gotten in to see the king. And here's where we have to do a little bit of thinking outside and around the box. Remember that when a person comes in to see the king, they are, and they have not been summoned, they are risking their life. The person knows that. The petitioner knows that. Not only that, but the king knows that. Which means the king knows that the person is aware that they are risking their own life to come in and speak to him. Then the king's expectations that are built up are of a very large and very significant request, one that would make it worthwhile to risk one's life. Therefore, we have to posit at this point that Ahasuerus, when he asks Esther what she wants, is ready to hear something very large. She wants another palace, she wants the head of her enemy, she wants a particular war to be fought, something very large that's worth risking. The king would also have to assume that it would be something that she would know the king would be ready to give, because she would not come unless the odds were in her favor. The king understands this, and therefore we assume, along with the king, that we're going to hear a very large request. We would be surprised, perhaps, if we were the king, but we, the reader, know all of this, so we would expect Esther at this point to say, well, he's granted me an audience, this is my one chance, I better ask him to rescind the decree. Vayomer la hamelech, ma'lach Esther hamalka. That's a deliberate play on words. Melech ma'lach. The king said to her, what would you like? What is your request? Even till half the kingdom, and it will be given to you. This, of course, is hyperbole. This is court speak. But the idea is whatever your heart desires. At this point, we would certainly expect her to say, save my people. However, we have a problem here. Save my people is not the whole request. The real full request is rescind the documents that were signed in your name by Haman, which means we're now going to have a contest of trust between Esther, who years ago was the king's favorite, but in the meantime has not been summoned for a month, against Haman, who has Ahasuerus's ear and who has the total trust of the king. Esther is wise enough to understand that she would likely not come out on the favored side of such a competition. So she constructs an elaborate plan, which is to trap both Haman and Ahasuerus in their own weaknesses. She's identified their vulnerabilities, and now she's going to attack them, and let's see how she does it. So let's think back. What do we know about Ahasuerus, and what do we know about Haman, if we were to try to draw a psychological portrait of them? Well, one thing we know about Ahasuerus from the text is that Ahasuerus has some challenges to his rule. As we pointed out in the very first podcast, it took him 3 years before he could have a coronation. As we saw at the end of the second chapter, his own cup guards are threatening to poison him and to kill him. There is all sorts of unrest going on in his kingdom. He is also aware that Esther is somebody that he's ignored for a while. Now, while Esther may be wondering, as I mentioned in the last podcast, who is Ahasuerus spending his nights with, in the meantime, Ahasuerus has to be thinking, how is Esther spending her time? That's one piece of the puzzle. So we know that Ahasuerus sits uneasily on his throne. What do we know about Haman? Well, besides what Mordechai has communicated to Esther, as we saw in the fourth chapter, that Haman is a traitor, and Haman has taken the trust of the king and betrayed it. Beyond that, we also know from the third chapter that Haman has a very weak self-image. Haman suffers from what we call egomania, an over-absorption and obsession with having his own image strengthened by outside validation, because he really has no self-image. And as a result of that, one person who refuses to bow down to him irritates him, angers him, he is seething because of this one fellow. And we have this bit of information about Ahasuerus and about Haman. Esther, as I said, puts together a plan to drive these two vulnerabilities against each other. How do you do it? So let's think about it. How do you defeat a paranoid person? Simply, you give him something to worry about. How do you defeat an egomaniac? It's the opposite. You build him up and build him up and build him up to the point where he is so filled of himself that the smallest little irritant can come along and destroy him. And we will see how both of those play out. Verse 4. Vatomer Esther, Imahal HaMelech Tov, Yavo HaMelech VeHaman HaYom El HaMishteh Asher Asiti Lo. If the king agrees, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I prepared for him. Now notice, Asher Asiti Lo has a triple entendre to it. The simplest reading of it is, it's something I prepared for him, meaning for the king, and Haman will come along. On a second level, Asher Asiti Lo, she mentioned two people, Ahasuerus and Haman, and it's almost as if she's saying, the two of you are really in one cahoots. He got a document, he's got your name signed to it, you are one unit, Asher Asiti Lo. And perhaps on a much deeper level, it's a banquet that I prepared for him being Haman. And if it's a banquet I prepared for him, it's a banquet at which ultimately, not this one, but the next one, will be his undoing. The king is pleased with this. However, we have to stop and think, what is the king going to do with the information that Esther wants Haman to come to this party? Well, we'll see. And there's something absolutely delicious about hearing this phrase. The king orders that Haman must come and do Esther's bidding. Esther invited him to the banquet. Haman is ordered by the king to do the bidding of Esther. And now suddenly we find that our protagonist and antagonist, Mordechai and Haman, within a short period of time, are both acting at the bidding of Esther. But what's particularly good for us, perspective reading it from the outside, is that Haman, unbeknownst to him, is now enslaved, as it were, acting on the orders of a woman who, as he does not know, he is slated for death. And the irony gets thicker. And now the king and Haman come, and we get the sense that it's quite immediate. They come to the feast that Esther had made. Now, let's play out how our two antagonists are feeling at the time, as much as we can guess. If you are Ahasuerus, you must be very curious. Esther risked her life to come to me, to ask me to come to a banquet. This banquet, this feast, must be something of great importance. She must have something very important that she wants to accomplish here. Accomplish. Maybe ask, maybe do. Ahasuerus doesn't know, but he must be very curious. And Esther is somebody who has already used mystery and discretion as a tool by not telling Ahasuerus who she was and from what nation she was. What happens at the party? We'll see. But in the meantime, if you're Haman, how do you feel? Well, Haman has to feel like his star is rising. He has recently been elevated to become the chief minister. He's somehow gotten all of the members of the court to bow down to him, whether the king really made such an order or not, as I suggested in chapter 3. And he has now successfully gotten a plan to get rid of his enemy and all of the enemy's folk, to wipe them out 11 months from now. He's feeling on top of his game. He has just had all of these documents sent out, and now a few days later, he is personally, among everyone else, invited to the banquet that the queen made for Ahasuerus and for him. He's got to be on top of the world. So that's the image that we have. What happens at the party? So he comes up to her at the party, and he says, he repeats the exact same formula. What do you want? Half the kingdom, I'll give it to you. Again, the protocol, again, the way to speak. However, note that the king hasn't waited for her to come and approach him. He understands that there's a request she has, and that instead of doing it in the throne room, she wants to make this request at the party. All right, she makes the request. He presents the opportunity. What's her request? And now we're all waiting. Not just us. All the waiters, all the valets, everyone is at the party, is waiting, and Ahasuerus is waiting with bated breath to hear what is it that Esther wants. Listen to this build-up. If I found favor in the king's eyes, and if it's good for the king, to give me my request and to do my bidding, to do what I'd like, then, yes, let the king and Haman come to the banquet that I'm going to make, and tomorrow I'll do what the king says. In other words, we've got another banquet tomorrow. And you and Haman, please come to this banquet. Tomorrow I'll tell you. So again, she leads him on. And the king, full of curiosity, but the curiosity is going to quickly turn to something else. And Haman, filled with validation, filled with excitement, filled with ego, is now had all of that times exponentially exploding. Now he's invited to another party as the single guest who's not a member of the royal family. So let's see. Vayetzeh Haman bayomahu sameach v'tov lev. We will not see how Achashverosh responds to this until the next chapter. But we see how Haman responds to this. Vayetzeh Haman bayomahu sameach v'tov lev. Haman left on that day happy, feeling good. Of course he's feeling good. V'chirot Haman et Mordechai b'shar melech. This is what I said about ego. By pumping up an egomaniac's ego and sense of self-importance, which is an illusion, it becomes that much easier. Imagine it almost as a balloon. The more you blow it up, the bigger it becomes. It takes up more space, and therefore more things can get in its way, and it's far tighter so that the smallest little pinprick can explode it. Haman has been pumped up to this huge level of self-importance and grandeur. And now what happens? He walks out, and who's standing there refusing to bow down to him right at the palace gates? None other than Mordechai. Chirot Haman at Mordechai, v'shar melech v'lo kam v'lo zami menu. And Mordechai didn't get up. He wasn't moved. He didn't care. V'yimalei Haman at Mordechai chema. Now Haman is filled with anger at Mordechai. And you notice the switch, the very quick switch from happiness and joy and excitement to absolute anger and rage. So what happens? Vayitapak Haman. And we get the sense that for him this was no easy matter. He restrained himself. Restrained himself from saying anything, from doing anything. Vayavol beto. He came home. Vayishlach vayavetu avav et zeresh ishto. He came and brought all of his friends and he brought his wife. Now this scene is one of the most pathetic scenes in Tanakh. Here is this man who has been elevated to this prime position, been invited as a private guest to the queen's banquet, and again tomorrow, and one guy is not bowing down to him. A guy who he's already got his number. And Haman walks in, he calls his wife, his friends, Vaisaper lahamayim Haman at Kvod HaShrover of Banav. And what does he do? He starts boasting about how great he is, how much his wealth he has, and how many kids he has. He's boasting to his own friends and to his wife about this. And how much the king has raised him and has elevated him above all of the other ministers and the courtiers of the king. So he's telling them, he's boasting about his greatness. Vayomer Haman, and what else does he say? Aflo hivya Esther Malkan l'mishtecha mishtecha rasata kimoti. And beyond that, Esther, the queen, did not call anybody else, did not invite anybody else to the banquet of the king except for me. V'gam l'machar nikaru l'ayim ha-melech. And tomorrow I'm invited again. Look how great I am. And then he says what is surely the most pathetic line in the Megillah, if not in all of Tanakh. V'chol ze einenu shoveh li. You almost see a little child having a tantrum, stamping his feet. None of this is equal, is worth it for anything for me. None of this is worth anything. Can you imagine this? This guy out of nowhere has been elevated to be the highest minister in the empire of the world. He's got a private, he is the private guest of the queen, 2 days running. He's got his enemy's number. Everything's fine, and none of it is worth anything to me. It's pathetic. As long as he Mordechai Yehudi sitting at the palace gates, as long as he's there, I can't have a good time. I can't enjoy any of this stuff. He's in my way. So what happens? So Zeresh and his friends told him the following. Why don't you have a tree erected, a gallows erected? It's 50 amot high. That's 100 feet, let's say. And in the morning, and pay attention to that, in the morning, go to the king. And tell the king you want Mordechai hanged. After all, if you are so close to the king, you could certainly ask for your enemy to be hanged. There's more to it than that. We'll see in a minute. And then you'll come to the king at the party. You'll be happy. And you'll have a good time. Haman liked it, and he had the tree set up, the gallows erected. But notice, they said, go in the morning. We'll find that Haman can't wait that long, and that's going to be part of his undoing. But there is another piece to the puzzle here. Haman has personal animus against Mordechai. Rav Yonatan Grossman, in a lovely article a number of years ago in Megadim, suggested that Haman's anger at the personal affront to him that Mordechai was representing by not bowing had clouded his judgment and kept him from seeing another piece to the puzzle. If indeed there is a royal decree that all of the members of the court have to bow down to Haman, then that means that Mordechai, as a member of the court, is in violation of that order, and as such is acting with treason, and as such could be hanged not as the personal enemy of Haman, but as a member of the court who is not conducting himself according to the rules of the court. So if so, Haman has every right to come to the king and say, this guy is not following the laws, and Ahasuerus, of course, will trust him, so that will work out. Of course, according to the way that I suggested, the solution to Mordechai's not bowing in that is that the king had never made written such an order. Nonetheless, had written an order for people to bow down to Haman, and that it was really all Haman's doing. Haman cannot come to the king and say, well, this guy Mordechai refuses to bow down, and that's a violation of your law, because the king never wrote such a law. But he certainly, as somebody who is on a very close relationship with the king and close terms with the king, should be able to come in and say, I have a particular enemy, and he's somebody who's giving me trouble, and, I'm your closest friend. I'm asking you a favor to have him hanged. Perhaps the king would agree to do that. Perhaps. But we will see, of course, how the nature of the events, the timing of the events, what may be coincidence and maybe God's hand behind the curtain, that's the way that we traditionally see it, will move things into a very different direction, as we will see in the next podcast. In the meantime, everyone should have a wonderful day.